If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the C-Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and this is episode number 528. Back in the saddle. Prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Thursday, September 6th, 2018. So, if you don't subscribe to the C-Realm Vault Podcast, you probably haven't heard my voice in quite some time. This is, in fact, the first regular free C-Realm Podcast that I've put out since May, and it coincides with this being the at least a record of the first live radio show I've done since then. Over the course of the summer, I have gotten out of the habit of going into the radio station, and more to the point, I've gotten out of the habit of arranging to have a guest calling into the radio station. And I've just been sharing the weekly C-Realm Vault podcast with the local terrestrial radio listening audience, or at least most of it. The C-Realm Vault podcast is frequently longer than an hour. And my radio show is exactly 1 hour long, and I have to read some public service announcements in it, so I often have to cut some of the content from the Vault podcast when putting it on the radio. But the upshot is that I haven't been creating any new interview material over the course of the summer. At least what little bit of new interview material I've created was either for the C-Realm Vault or was for somebody else's podcast. So, for example, I've recently been a guest on the Greening the Apocalypse radio show and podcast, also Zero Squared with Doug Lane, and very soon, I think as early as next week, I will be the guest on the Attack Ads podcast. Now, those of you who do listen to the C-Realm Vault podcast know that I still put out a podcast about once a week. It averages to once a week. Sometimes they come in clusters, and sometimes you have a dry spell, but on average, I put out 4 podcasts a month for the paying C-Realm Vault subscribers. By the way, all new subscribers need to go through Patreon now. You can find my Patreon account at patreon.com/KMO. And of course, there is a link to it from my website, crealm.com. Alrighty, so what you're going to hear in this episode of the C-Realm Podcast is a conversation that was broadcast over the radio. It was a live call-in radio conversation. Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator and a familiar voice, I think, to most C-Realm listeners, certainly to most C-Realm Vault subscribers, called in from his home in Portland. He had basically just come back from a vacation back to the old country. He was fresh back from an extended visit to Ireland. So much of what we'll talk about is basically what being in Ireland for a time brought to mind or, you know, highlighted for Dermot about living in the United States. The website that archives my radio show, it's called Radio Free America, their clock is a little out of sync with the radio station clock, so the first part of the conversation didn't get recorded, but it was mostly just friendly how-do-you-dos, and I think you'll be able to pick up on the content of the conversation within a few seconds of where the recording actually begins. All right, here is my conversation with Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator.
You're listening to the C-Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
I was hooked on Age of Empires. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, Civilization 4 was my downfall forever. But then when my son was visiting, I ordered a new SSD or an SSD for my old laptop, and he had to reinstall Windows. And I don't have the original disk for Civ 4, so it is now off my computer. And you know, I could go get a pirated copy somewhere, but I'm not going to. Just the fact that it's not there, that I can't just click a little icon on screen and have it start. That's enough to keep me off of it. Yeah. I like that you described Facebook as a heat sink, because that word heat comes up in other contexts related to people basically lashing out online. Like if you just give your reflexive response to something, you know, without really giving it much deep thought, just your off-the-cuff response, it's called a hot take. And when people are in that mode of giving their hot take and a conversation is dominated by that kind of thinking, we say that, you know, there's lots of heat and no light. So I really like Facebook as a heat sink. I love that metaphor.
Yeah. My girlfriend is a member of a group that is on the surface like it's a very nice and healthy group, and most of the people on there are decent, but she'll show me these threads that just light up like like volcanoes, and I just scratch my head when she's reading some of these threads. Like, guys, they're movies, you know, and any perceived indiscretion or bad thought or bad motivation is assumed. I mean, there's bad faith is assumed as the default position. If somebody posts, I don't like Wonder Woman, can anyone tell me, you know, what's so great about it? And then this is perceived as an attack on feminism. So these threads immediately degenerate into like a culture war. And the poor schlub who posts this comment, now maybe he was trolling, you know, this is the other thing, but maybe he's just a schlub. And then it's like a horror show that goes on for page after page after page of people yelling at this poor fool for daring to not like Wonder Woman. But then you have to think, it's a Wonder Woman, it's a movie. You know, we have actual women in the world who, you know, who need help. And this is a movie made by a multi-million dollar corporation. You know, it's get real and get some perspective. And it's just this descent down to this bottomless whelp. And this is a movie made by a multi-million dollar corporation. You know, it's get real and get some perspective. And it's just this descent down to this bottomless well of stories and fiction, and where the movie is more real than reality. And I think maybe Facebook's a part of that. You know, that feed is just another hologram.
Well, there is a guest that I talk to from time to time. His name is Brian Collar. And he's an American, but he lives in Ireland right now. And he has conservative friends and liberal friends and basically friends from across the political spectrum. He writes for some, you know, some publications which are considered conservative, like American Conservative. It would be hard to spin that one as not being conservative. But he expressed an opinion that sort of surprised me and gave me a little bit of friction and psychological trouble. He doesn't like that social media has opened up this opportunity for people to endlessly examine popular media. So, you know, you can't have, as you described it, you know, an innocent superhero film. Every film, particularly, you know, popular films, big blockbuster extravaganzas, get endlessly analyzed to death, just combed over in microscopic detail and every minor little blemish brought into the light of day and you know, just paraded and shown as evidence of some great sin on the part of the studio or the filmmaker or the audience. And, you know, movies, as they were originally conceived, weren't built to stand up to that sort of minuscule microscopic scrutiny. And yep. You can really ruin a good film, or, you know, you can ruin people's ability to enjoy an okay film with that. But at the yep. same time, I watch a lot of film criticism stuff on YouTube, and it has really enriched my, you know, my ability to dig into a movie on levels that I wouldn't have done just watching it on my own. So it's really a double-edged sword for me.
Yeah, it depends who's doing the reading. And Slavoj Žižek is somebody that I don't enjoy reading at all. But I had this really weird experience where the first piece of writing he ever wrote was really good, and I keep hoping that he'll write something as accessible as that, but he never has.
What was
but
it?
But his reading of Titanic. Titanic is a vampire movie. And I won't try to do the voice. People who know what he sounds like don't need to hear that. But he said basically it's a vampire movie, and Kate Winslet's a vampire, and she's depleted, being this member of this, like, you know, blue-blooded aristocratic class. And their existence is vampiric upon the working class people down in third class. And she finds a little work.
Dermot, are you there? It is possible that we have lost Dermot O'Connor.
Essence.
Oh, there you are.
And then when she's done draining him, she drops him into the middle of the ocean.
Hey, Dermot, you cut out for about 20 seconds there, maybe less, maybe like 15 seconds. But could you back up a little bit and flesh out Slavoj Žižek's reading of Titanic as a vampire movie?
Will do. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. So, yeah, he said that Kate Winslet's character is a vampire, and being an aristocrat, blue blood, she has no life energy, and that she gets this life energy by draining Leonardo DiCaprio, who's a member of the working class. And you see all the vitality of the poor people and the Irish people down in steerage. So she gets him, she drains him dry, And then when she's done with them, she dumps them into the middle of the ocean. So I thought, now that's an example of a really clever reading of a movie. And it really makes you think. You can never watch that movie again without thinking maybe she's a vampire. But the thing is, to do these kind of readings, you have to have some degree of wit, intelligence, humor, irony, you know. And a lot of the people doing it now are just amateurs, and they're not very good at it. You see the result, or they're very emotionally unstable. And they begin projecting their own psychic demons onto the external world or to the movie or whatever. And I think there's a lot of that going on.
And there is apparently quite an appetite for that sort of thing, because a lot of those folks develop significant online followings.
Yeah, because people like heat. They like anger. They like righteous indignation. And I can do it. I can do that with the best of them, but I know what it is. You know, it's not a replacement for political action. When I was back in Ireland late July, early August, and I have a friend over there who works for the Irish Parliament. He does design work for various political parties, mostly on the left side of the aisle. And we were talking about this, and he said, yeah, people don't want to do like grassroots work and organizing on the street, because it's really, really difficult. And they would much rather sit behind a keyboard and tap, tap, tap away. But that's not politics. It's something that John Michael Greer wrote a couple of years ago, that you don't create democracy by voting. That's how you consume it. You create democracy by grassroots activism. And that means physical labor on the street, you know, in reality, handing out soup, you know, whatever it is, door stopping people, going up to people, talking to people, trying to raise money, doing all that horrible stuff that's really boring and nasty and probably pointless anyway. But that's politics. That's how you make democracy. You don't do it by ranting on the internet.
Well, there are a couple factions of people who are enthusiastically out in the streets being quite physical and demonstrative in their, their version of political action. You can probably guess who I'm talking about, because Portland, Oregon is a hotbed for them.
Yeah. I mentioned my girlfriend now. She was shot by the Portland police last year. There was the incident where one of these racists from Vancouver, I think, Vancouver, Washington, and right across the river, was attacking or verbally assaulting a Muslim woman on the MAX, the local light rail system. And some men tried to stop him. He stabbed them. I think two died. And that triggered off a bunch of protests. So she went between Antifa and the white nationalist fools. So she went down to photograph it, and the police just began very curtly calling out, disperse from the park. And within moments, I mean, nobody had time to even move. They started firing flash grenades or grenades into the crowd, and one of these exploded near her, and she had a scar on her leg to prove it, and the video to prove it. So that's currently undergoing a lawsuit. So, that's a kind of a little personal anecdote. So the Portland PD are very quick, very trigger happy. They'd be very happy in Northern Ireland in the 1970s, in my opinion. They'd be delighted. But it's the kind of thing that, here it definitely is kind of a ground zero for that kind of street theater. But even so, those kind of actions where you're going out onto the streets and shouting at people are more theater, I think, than meaningful political action. Like, I would be worried if the crazies were setting up soup kitchens for the poor, you know. But the thing is, that's hard. You know, if the white nationalists were setting up soup kitchens, that'd be really difficult. It's easy to go out and throw a few rocks at people, and it's easy to stab people, as it turns out, but it's really difficult to actually do social outreach, and they're not doing that. So neither side is, to my eyes anyway. So there's a lot of this, again, heat sink behavior, where people are acting out and they're kind of lost in the world of signs and symbols. And this is really funny. It only occurred to me recently. One criticism you'll see of the cultural left, let's call it, or the kids on college campuses, is that they're postmodernists, and they're, you know, all they care about is, you know, slogans. And then you look at the guys on the right, and what do they have as their mascot? A frog, a cartoon frog. And all that they're obsessed about, a world of signs and symbols. They're all postmodernists. they're all the product of the same society, and they all basically use the same techniques. One side talks about meme magic, and the other talks about hashtags. None of them are engaged in meaningful physical action. None of them are engaged in meaningful material action. It's all cartoons, statues, flags. It's all an obsession with symbols. And the things that the symbols represent almost don't even get a foot in the door.
This is not something that I think is the result of a grand conspiracy of, you know, people in Silicon Valley who said, hey, let us build this enormous infrastructure for, you know, allowing people to contact one another and express themselves, you know, to a wider audience. But let's do it in such a way that it is really predatory on some inbuilt human psychological tendencies. And let's just crank everybody's irritation with each other to 11 and see what happens. I think it's more a matter of just the sort of perverse downstream effects of the web being funded by advertising. And advertisers not caring what gets you to look at a page or to stay engaged on a platform, just as long as your eyeballs are there looking at an ad, they're happy. And the social media companies and other players figuring out the easiest and cheapest and most reliable way to keep people engaged with your site is to get them angry. And, you know, you can get them angry at people who believe things that they don't believe. And you can get them angry by threatening their sense of personal, you know, safety and sovereignty by criticizing some aspect of their worldview. You know, it's not a really adaptive feature of our psychology, but we do treat criticisms of our worldview as, you know, psychologically and physiologically, we respond the same way as we would respond to a physical threat. So it's really easy to get people cranked up and, you know, really crank up the us versus them mentality. But it's not anything that anybody planned to do for its own sake, at least not anybody in a position, you know, to create the infrastructure. It's just it's what happens when you combine these tools with a profit motive and advertising.
Yeah, it's an emergent phenomenon. Yeah, the capital only cares about expansion. It doesn't have a moral bone in its body. And one thing that's really disturbing to me is to see people, and you can see it in the way they write and the way they talk about various companies, that they really think that these are benign entities in many cases. And many of the people who think this would call themselves liberals or will call themselves left. And the way they appeal. I know the last time we spoke, I remember you talked about how, you know, big businesses love identity politics. And, you know, you'll see the same business that, you know, will virtue signal. To borrow a right-wing term, which I think is a great term, with a virtue signal all over the place about how tolerant they are, and they'll have the right, like, cohort of faces on their posters and everything. And then they'll be paying their employees $15 an hour, or not even $15. I saw recently that Disney World employees finally unionized and got a pay rise to $15 an hour. And a lot of people online are complaining about that because, oh, now the ticket prices will go up. Well, you know, forgive me if I don't begrudge some poor devil who has to wear a goofy costume in the Florida heat for being paid $15 an hour, which is what, $600 a week? You know, this is hardly a Bolshevik revolution. And this is the same company that'll be, when I work there, you'll see their signs all over. We're an equal opportunities employer. Well, tell that to the guy who worked at Imagineering for 25 years as a temp, you know, as a temp, he doesn't get benefits. He doesn't get any retirement. Tell it to the guy that they laid off 2 weeks before he was due to retire because, oh, we're not firing you. We're eliminating your position. You know, when it comes to, you know, the virtue signaling, when it comes to money, the virtue stops very, very quickly and they become very, very reptilian about things. And, you know, so you'd work inside this company and they have all these like morale boosting things and you just, assuming you've been around the block a few times, you just go, yeah, right. You know, don't pretend you people care about us. You don't care about anybody. You only care about money. That's the only color they care about. Like the old George Carlin sketch, you know, they don't care about you. They don't care about you. They don't care about you. And it breaks my heart to see young people lost in this, like these appeals to corporate America for social justice. You know, you're barking up the wrong tree there. And they're in for a very rude awakening.
Well, the ones in college will be in for a rude awakening when they leave college and they have to earn a living. And they discover that these corporate behemoths are more than happy to just chew you up, suck the vitality out of you and spit you out again. You know, Amazon is a famously progressive company, but it's also a famously miserable company to work for, particularly if you are, you know, have the misfortune to be in one of their so-called fulfillment centers, you know, which is their warehouses. They don't offer, you know, year-round employment. They have seasonal employment at a lot of these places, and there is they prefer older workers because older workers tend to be more responsible. They tend to take their work more seriously. They tend to show up when they say they're going to. And, you know, it's really physically demanding labor. And there are communities, like mobile tribes of senior citizens who drive around the U.S. in their RVs, basically chasing seasonal employment in Amazon fulfillment centers, where they suffer greatly. I mean, just physically. I worked for Amazon, but not in a physical capacity. I suffered psychologically when I was there. But you know, they're suffering physically with these long days, long walks on, you know, concrete pavement, or, and having to basically pass through metal detectors and personal searches and lining up to, you know, submit to these searches off the clock. Basically, they're not getting paid when they're waiting to get patted down or to walk through the metal detector. It is just it's an Orwellian and just miserable, miserable existence. And yet, you know, Amazon says all the right things about race and gender.
No, it's despicable. And they're using it as a fig leaf. And whenever I talk to people, you know, I'm at ground zero for liberalism. I mean, Portland is just crazy. I'll hand on heart. I'm telling you, I'm really having a hard time justifying living in America at this point. My sister moved back home 2 years ago, and she's never been happier. She lived in America for 23 years. She's got a 8-year-old daughter, and she thought, I just can't justify this anymore. The health mess alone, having to spend $1,200 a month on health care that doesn't cover anything really, you know, was ridiculous. So she goes back home, and now she's paying, I think, it's like $200 a month, and she gets complete health coverage for that. And if she didn't do that, she'd still get on the national health system such as we have, and then you'd be on a waiting list. But both options are better than what you have in America. And I was back a little while ago and just noticed that things were so much happier there. I mean, it's flipped since I left. I left in 93, and coming to America, it was like stepping into like a movie set. And now it's the opposite. Now I go back and Irish people just are all like optimistic. And even after the 2008 crash there and all the problems that the country still has, it's just night and day. And one thing that my sister said to me was, it's so great here. You can say what you like. Like people aren't like policing their language. Because people there at least know the difference between words and things and actions, and everyone that they delight in saying shocking things, that doesn't make you a Nazi. And somebody will tell you like a really horrible joke, and they go, "Oh, for God's sake!" And they'll move on. And it's just that sense of like, yeah, I can breathe again. And here in Portland, like I'll bump into people, and I'll start talking, and I go, "Oh God, here we go, here we go," and I'm trying to like think of an example, but it's just, you just get the sense people are in kind of a mental prison, and they don't see the walls. So how do you get out of a prison when you don't know what even you're in it? And it's just, it's really depressing. So it's, you know, I'm 49, and 11 years I'll be 60, and I'm just having a really hard time justifying staying much longer, because I don't want to be 60 years old in America and not have family here. So yeah. I do feel sorry for people who can't see the kind of the mental prison that actually I think is stronger with liberals than it is with conservatives in some ways. They both have shared characteristics, but they're both these systems that imprison your thought and force you down these paths to things like identity politics, and they're appealing to your best nature. That's the really sick thing about them. They're kind of a bait and switch that appeal to your innate sense of goodness. And that's something that I'm getting tired of real fast.
You are listening to Sea Realm Radio. I am your host, KMO. This is WOOL FM 91.5, community radio from Bellows Falls, Vermont. I'm speaking with Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator, fresh back from Ireland, where he's gotten basically a taste of an easier, nicer, more comfortable way of life. But Dermot, I know well that you know that there is a connection between what we've been talking about in terms of the effects that the big tech companies are having on our daily experience and on the character of public life here in the United States and what's happening in Ireland, because Ireland has become a very inviting place for these tech companies to park their profits and not pay taxes on them here in the United States. So Ireland basically is deriving some benefit, you know, from being the tax haven for Silicon Valley.
Yeah, there was when I was back, there was a jaw-dropping article in the Irish Times, and it said that something like 60% of the Irish economy now is tech, and they can boil that down to about four or five companies. So were those, you were talking about Apple, Google, Facebook, would be three of those. So it's basically the Irish economy, you can sum it up as tech and big pharma. And were those five or six, say, big companies to leave the country, the Irish economy would collapse, like, overnight. And so it's not an optional feature anymore. It's like that's the bedrock of the Irish economy now is computers. So it's the opposite of what when Bord Fáilte, the Irish tourist board, are selling holidays to Americans. They're not showing you the Google plant down on the docks in Dublin. They're showing you the drone footage of green fields. But I was going through Dublin one of my recent trips, and there was a part of the city that used to be just like, you know, like just ruined and abandoned, like something James Joyce would have recognized. And I thought, wait, what? Who? What? And there were all these gigantic glass buildings, and there was like a train station stop that didn't exist the last time I was home. And there's a lot of issues now in Dublin with property prices getting rocketed up. I mean, my biggest issue if I do move home will be rental or prices or property prices, because other than that, I could do it. But that's the one thing that would probably stop me. The thing is, it's the same thing that's happening here. So it's happening there too.
So Dermot, you are an animator. You have had a long career in animation. You have an IMDb entry. You have worked on films that people have heard of. But you, I think right now, derive at least a significant portion of your income teaching animation online through lynda.com.
Yeah.
Could you do that from Ireland?
Yes, I could. I could. And they're a great company. I mean, and now they're bought by LinkedIn, and LinkedIn are bought by Microsoft. So I'm part of that tech machine now. You can't escape. There's no escape. Yeah, what can you do? But no, they've been good to me. I'm not going to lie. They've been really nice to me. And normally when I've worked for other companies where, you know, they got bought out by another company. And I don't know if you know Futurama, but the TV show that Matt Groening did. Every time Professor Farnsworth comes in and he says, "Good news, everybody." that's been my experience every time a company was bought out. You know, somebody comes in and goes, "Good news, everybody. We've been bought out by X. Dermot, pack your bags and leave." And so I was waiting for this again. Here we go. This would be nice, but oh God. And it hasn't happened. So it's only been good to me. So I'm touch wood. It stays that way. But no, the nice thing about it is, yeah, they've told me, look, we have authors in Britain and we fly them out. You know, you might come out for 2 weeks because it's a long trip. So you might fly it for 2 weeks and do more recording, but we make it work. Oh, fine. So that's good to know. But yeah, the problem with animation now is it's just getting work. It's so distributed. You know, back in the day, it was harder too. You'd have to go to Los Angeles or London or maybe Berlin, and you'd be physically moving. Whereas now a lot of it can be done remotely. But the thing is, the work is more sporadic too. Like the glory days of hand-drawn animation are finished. And so now, you know, teaching is for me, it's a safer path. I have friends who work on Family Guy and another who works on The Simpsons. But when those shows end, and even they will end, then I don't know what they'll do. So they're just like work. another season of Family Guy, thank God. And, you know, when those shows end, they're going to throw 500 people onto the street, and they'll be going into the competing for those dwindling animation jobs. So yeah, it can be gruesome.
Well, I think there are a lot of jobs in animation. It's just most of the people doing them are in the Philippines or Eastern Europe or Bangladesh, you know, and they're being paid what would be, you know, a wage that would be impossible for somebody living in the United States to compete with.
Yeah, that's true. And I notice, like, I get fined a lot on LinkedIn now for my courses. A lot of my students find me, and I would say 90% of the students who friend me are in the Middle East or Asia, and easily not pushing 80 to 90%, something like that. And it tells me where the wind is blowing. But then again, a lot of the work they do, too, is for their local markets as well. And they would have, like, a better sense of, like, things like body language. We had a very funny thing happen on a side anecdote on when I worked for Disney. We did animation for the Japanese market. And we did this little animation of Mickey Mouse. And it was very simple. And it was just Mickey speaking. And they had it in Japanese, so we did it in phonetics. And he does this very simple little hand gesture that just holds his hands out. And we sent it over to them, and they sent it back. And they said, no, this doesn't work. He looks like he's angry. And all it was to, like, a Westerner was, like, a very simple little hand gesture. So the subtleties of the Japanese body language couldn't be understood by an American animator. So we just sent them the files, and they just animated it themselves. So there are subtleties like that. And I know that's been the problem with some of the shows done in Korea, that some of the Korean body language, when it's drawn, has to be – we have to send it when – comes to Family Guy, they have to say, no, it doesn't look right, send it back. And these scenes get ping-ponged across the Pacific many times, like 5, 6, 7 times until it's done right. So it's pretty tough. I mean, it's, you know, even though the guys are over there and working cheaper than an American studio could do, I wonder about the efficiency of some of this.
Well, I wonder how long it's going to be before there's any need for humans in the animation process at all. It seems like software will be taking up more and more of the, you know, the actual work that animators do.
Yeah, that's been the drift. Like, since I began in 1988, and it was all paper and pencil, and everything was done physically. And during that time, like, one department after another was getting subsumed by computers. And, you know, some of that work was pretty tedious. But like the entire cell painting and ink and paint, that disappeared into the computer. And you still need people to run the computers, but you could do it with maybe 5% or 10% of the department. And that's been the case. They can't quite reduce the animators out of the process yet. And some in-betweening still has to be done by hand for some styles. It varies a little bit. But yeah, they're definitely trying to, you know, make the humans as small a component as they can.
Let me tell you a fairly perverse story. As you well know, I assume you know, I post links to it all the time. I do a weekly comic strip. It comes out every Sunday, and I get paid for it. You know, each strip, it's sponsored by a political organization called Progressives for Immigration Reform. And, you know, I like to write it. I like to lay it out. I like to draw the characters. But then once the characters are drawn, then there's many, many, many hours of adding in the backgrounds, the background tones, you know, the gradients to give a sort of 3D look to it. And the actual drawing part takes less than a quarter of the total production time. The rest of it is just fiddly little stuff, and I can get lost in it and do more than really needs to be done. So I took advantage of what is it called? Upwork, which is, you know, basically a way to hire freelancers online. And I started paying people to basically do the part of the comic strip that isn't very gratifying to me. And right. The people that I was paying to do it could do it as quickly as I could, and they could make it look pretty much like it would if I did it myself. And in fact, the first couple times that I employed somebody to do that, nobody at the organization, you know, for whom I do the work noticed any difference in the look of the strip. And then I realized, okay, I'm paying people in Ukraine to do work for me that I am doing on behalf of an organization, a political organization, which is basically lobbying against the outsourcing of labor from the United States. And so I thought, okay, this is dumb. This is completely antithetical to the whole mission of this organization. So I'm going to hire an American to do this work. And so I made arrangements with this American cartoonist to do the work. And he seemed quite enthusiastic about it. And he was going to do it for the same amount of money that I was paying the guy in Ukraine. And he totally flaked on me. And I ended up having to stay up all night doing the work, you know, myself to get it, you know, ready to be posted the next day. So, you know, it's perverse from two different directions. And then I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to do this work myself. And, you know, maybe if I'm really frustrated with this part of the process, it will motivate me to streamline this part of the process and figure out how to do it quicker.
Yeah, there's always a trick. There's always like a technique. I've through years of just trial and error, I've stumbled over a method that works for me, where it's just basically keep everything on layers. You know, as long as everything's drawn on a separate layer, then you can mess around with it or make really big changes. But the second I compile everything onto one layer, then I get into trouble.
Well, I certainly have a lot of layers going when I'm working on one of these things. But I'm working on a program called Clip Studio Paint, which used to be called Manga Studio. And I get so many layers going that, you know, I get lost. I'm like, okay, I'm trying to do something. I'm trying to do something and it's not working. It's like, what's going on? It's like, oh, okay, I'm on the wrong layer. But then at one point I was drawing on the wrong layer. Or I was coloring on the wrong layer and I didn't notice it. And now it's like, okay, I can't change this and I'm on the right layer. Where are these pixels actually? So,
right.
You know, yeah. I'm waiting for the AI. I want to write the strip. I want to draw it. And then I want to hand it off to the AI and say, okay, make this make this look like this.
Oh, God, that'll be good for you, bad for me. So when I can talk to the computer and make it draw like a Don Bluth cartoon, then I'm in trouble.
Well, then you turn to your authorial role, because I know that you are a writer of comics as well as an illustrator and animator.
Yep.
Talk about that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, so I've been I burnt out on the day job back in 2006 or so, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And I thought, okay, I can do a bit of work, but I can't do this for 50, 60 hours a week. I'm just burnt. So I decided just to start working on my own stuff. So I spent 7 years working on my own movie called There's No Tomorrow, which is on YouTube, and it's about a peak oil and the economy, and basically it's an anti-growth imperative movie, which a lot of the people who watch it don't understand because they fall asleep after the first 5 minutes.
It's a beautiful film, I should say. I give it my highest recommendation. It is just lovely to look at. And even though the title and the tone are maybe a little alarmist even for you now, it is still good information that is worth taking in.
I do regret the title. I didn't mean it to be quite as doomerish as I think people took it. People are very literal. And if I do an updated version, the title will be To Boldly Grow, and not to really push the actual message of the movie up front and to make it blatant. So I might do a comic book version if I do that, though, rather than I have it done. I just need to update some of the stats, because obviously a lot of the oil production stats are out of date and things have changed with fracking and all the rest of it. But other than that, I think it's still the basic message. I still stand over it. But I don't want people reading that. Like the 2030 extinction people love the movie, which drives me crazy because that's not in any way in the movie, but they've just latched onto it. And they're like, here we go again with like the fans of a thing who really the filmmaker is looking at this going, what movie were you looking at? Because it wasn't the one I made. I mean, my movie is very, for anyone who knows John Michael Greer, very influenced by John Michael Greer and very opposed to 2030, the extinction idea. But anyway, and now I'm currently working on, since 2012, since finishing that, a comic book called Continuum. And Continuum, the elevator pitch is Albert Einstein takes a young George W. Bush on an adventure through space, time, and philosophy. So... as you can imagine, it kind of covers a lot of ground. The idea is to take a lot of the ideas people have that are wrong and to show them, no, this is actually what this idea refers to. And, you know, this is the difference between idealism, realism, and nominalism. In other words, for example, let's take the entire human race and arrange them from the blackest black person to the whitest white person. And you use skin color as the defining position, or any variable you like, it doesn't matter which. At no two points will you be able to walk between any two people and say this is where this group begins and this group ends. So the differences between people are real, but the categories, white, black, whatever you're having, those are entirely imaginary. They're only inside your head. So these, in other words, this is medieval nominalism, beginning with Peter Abelard and scholastics like him. And it was one of the key intellectual developments on the way to the modern scientific worldview. And a lot of people in the modern world seem to be very keen on chucking this in the scrap heap. And so this is one of the major themes of the book, Continuum. It's to try to wake people out of the trance, to go, you know, you really have to constantly be aware of your mind's habit to reify or abstract these categories, which are only imaginary. They're only inside your head. And you can apply it to many things, trees to shrubs, asteroids to planets. There's a continuum of objects from one to the other. Our categories are only inside our head. They don't exist in nature. And if you want to, what I see happening a lot is people flipping. They'll go from, they'll say, you know, race is a construct, gender is a construct, blah, blah, blah. And in the next sentence, all white males are dot, dot, dot. Now, you've just flipped from realism to nominalism. I'm not picking a side here. I'm asking you to pick a side here, imaginary person in my head. But, you know, I've seen this online so many times, I pull my hair out. You can't do that. These are incompatible systems. They're not compatible. You have to choose. Make up your mind. And I know that when they're using these language, they're using it in the literal sense. They're not using it in, like, an ironic sense. They're being absolutely literal. It's typical. And then a white male. Well, again, I think this is a recipe for a form of mental illness, because you might not consciously realize why these two ideas are conflicting, but some part of your mind must, and we're struggling to try to fit these two different things that can't be fit together. And so anyway, that's one of the major themes in Continuum. And it's really, the book was originally aimed at racists. It was aimed at, like, trying to snap people out of the racist delusion. But as it turns out now, it's also really good for snapping liberals out of their delusions. You know, you have to pick one or the other, and you have to be very mentally tough about what Korzybski called being conscious of abstraction. Your mind is constantly abstracting from reality things that are only inside your, you know, these categories are only good if they're useful to you, but they can also be problematic to you. They can actually, his book is called Science and Sanity, because he did believe, and I think rightly, that getting, being unable to think clearly about these things could drive a person crazy. And I think it is driving people crazy. The alt-right are going crazy because, you know, they have this white thing in their heads. And the other side just flipped the polarity, the moral poles. They keep the white, the black-white lingo, and they just flip the poles. Good guy, bad guy hats get swapped. It's like a sort of a trance people are in. And I've got books on my shelf here that go back to the 60s, Race, Man's Most Dangerous Myth. And that was, again, a deconstruction of the idea that races are real. And, you know, and it doesn't, the idea of a race doesn't stand up philosophically, never mind scientifically. You can pull it apart metaphysically or biologically. It's just an absurdity. And yet you see all these people running around getting into race wars with one another. You're fighting about a thing that only exists inside your head. If you want to fight racism, you strike the root, not the branch. You go for the root. The root is the idea that there is such a thing as race. And that's hard because it's like going back to Heraclitus and the ancient Greeks, you know, the everything is in flux. So I think that level of thought might be beyond most people. I don't know, but I'd like to think, at least hope the project gets through to a few. But I don't have any great hopes at this point. I think we're too far gone.
You mentioned Alfred Korzybski, and that reminded me of Robert Anton Wilson, because Robert Anton Wilson was certainly an evangelist for the ideas of Korzybski. And I recalled reading, it might have been Prometheus Rising. I'm not sure which Robert Anton Wilson book it was. But there was a book where he described basically the insanity in Ireland over the topic of abortion. And there was a woman who had been accused of being pregnant by two different men at the same time. It was a concept called superfecundation. And and Robert Anton Wilson was basically describing what an insane social atmosphere ruled in Ireland because of the power of the Catholic Church. And Ireland has just had a referendum in which they have changed their constitution and made abortion legal.
By a huge margin. I mean, not by a small margin. It was 68%, I think, or 65%. And this is, you know, I veer towards an optimistic note here, but when, however bad people think things are, when they do change, they can change with, like, really shocking speed. And like, when I left Ireland in 1993, homosexuality was still illegal or just about to be decriminalized. I think contraception, like condoms, you had to get a doctor's prescription, at least into the late 80s, early 90s. No pornography, no strip clubs, none of the all, no divorce, no abortion, on and on and on and on. And the church seemed to be at the apex of its power. And I think Toynbee or some historian wrote that civilizations build their greatest monuments just before they collapse. And if that's the case, you know, maybe I've seen it happen. I mean, most of the change people talk about in Ireland happened over the window of about 5 years. And I remember about a year or two after I'd left the country, it was 95 or 96, there was a left-wing politician called Emmett Stagg, and he was a minister for Labour or something like that in the coalition government. And he was caught in the Phoenix Park with a male prostitute. And I thought, oh, poor Emmett, that's him done for. And I would get the news. This is before the internet was easily accessible, so I was reading it via the papers, you know, that were coming through. And basically people asked, does this affect how he does his job? No. Well then, who cares? That was it. And now, this was 1994, 1995 when this was going on. And I realized even then that something fundamental had changed in the Irish psyche. And I think it was changing around 1990, 91 was sort of an inflection. And within a few years, then the whole thing was just teetering. And the abortion thing was just the last, that was the last holdout. And I think it was only political cowardice that was preventing the politicians from pushing that. They could have pushed that a lot sooner. And I think they were just so terrified of rerunning the 1980 abortion referendum. That was traumatic for everybody. And we had gay marriage before America. We had through popular vote. We have abortion through popular vote. So I was up in the coffee shop 2 days ago, and there were two American liberal ladies at the next table. One of them had gotten back from Ireland, and they were talking about Ireland in a sort of patronizing way about how, oh yeah, they're not as church bound as they used to be. And I was boiling, I was fuming. And I thought, you know what, ladies, you know, you're talking in a very patronizing way about a country that doesn't have school shootings, that had gay marriage through popular vote, abortion through popular vote. And what were they doing? They're doing some family planning charity, because it's under such threat in America. You wouldn't have to do that in Ireland, because that would be a guaranteed medical right, you know. So you can throttle down on the little pats on the head for the little Irish. You know, you should have been going there to learn how the little Irish were doing things, because we're far more left-wing. Our most right-wing party was actually sort of, in some respects, to the left of some Democrats, you know. So, yeah, you might want to rethink that. But, yeah, so, no, change happens, and it happens quickly. And sadly, the other way around, too. You know, it can go bad very quickly as well. But it can also, things that seem to be very strong can actually be very weak. And then when they go, everyone's scratching their head, like, what happened to the Catholic Church? You know? Like, if my grandparents were alive now, they just would not understand the country. It would be like France to them.
When I first left Amazon.com and I had a lot of money and I could travel and do as I wished, one of the first things I did was fly to Washington, D.C. to attend a conference at the Cato Institute. They had a conference called, Beyond Prohibition, Sane Drug Policy for the 21st Century. And they had a bunch of people there, including Gary Johnson, you know, who ran for president on the Libertarian ticket, mm-hmm. and who's now running for the Senate. And also, that was the first place I ever heard Ethan Nadelman talk. And he had a great metaphor. He said, support for the drug war is 100 miles high, 100 miles wide, and 1 inch thick. Because, you know, at the time, particularly, a lot of people would nod their head and assent to things that they didn't really believe, but which it was, you know, politically and socially just suicidal to not go along with, you know, that the drugs were evil, that they were, you know, the only answer was prohibition and long jail sentences and more police and, you know, just more interdiction. And that mentality seems to, it's not gone. You know, certainly the drug war apparatus and the police and the prison system is still thriving, stronger than ever, but support for it seems to be at an all-time low, and I don't see it coming back anytime soon.
Yeah. I saw two Portland cops arresting some poor old homeless guy, put stuffing him into the back of their car, and the young cop was going to the little pathetic tin of his needles and things, and he goes, yeah, got this, and he goes, illegal drug, blah, blah, blah. I actually heard him say that, like something along that lines. Like, and you could sense that the young cop thought, this isn't why I became a cop. You know, hopefully not to shoot women in the leg with flash grenades or to arrest like some poor harmless junkie who's just trying to sleep away his misery, you know? Yeah, it's, I think that'll go. But, you know, hope they'll probably find a way to make money off legalizing all this stuff anyway. That's the trick. Once they make more money off making it legal, then things change real fast.
Yep. I now live in the first state that authorized legal recreational marijuana through the legislature, not a ballot initiative, because we don't have those here. The Vermont legislature actually, and they've been trying to do it for years. It was the governor, you know, Phil Scott, our governor last year, he vetoed it after sitting on the legislation until the very last minute, and then, you know, vetoed it so that it was too late for the legislature to change the bill to accommodate his criticisms of it. So they, you know, we had to wait a whole nother year for it. But right. You know, he, you know, the second year, this last year or this year, they gave him basically the same bill with the changes that he asked for, and he had very little choice but to sign it, and he did.
Right.
So hooray!
Yeah. And it's so harmless. We have pot dispensaries here. You just go in, you can buy whatever you need, and the sky doesn't fall. And you know, you realize, yeah, all those years, that moral panic, you know, these moral panics. That's all that's, all, you know, moral panics everywhere. There's one for everyone, you know. And they're all just, they're just imagined phantoms for the most part.
You know, individual moral panics, they come and go. So the drug war, reefer madness, moral panic is on its last legs. But moral panics as a category seem to be thriving. Ooh. You know, they just find new instantiations.
Yeah. All it takes is like the wrong portrayal. There was, I don't know how much time you have, but there was a movie recently about okay. Joaquin Phoenix plays John Callahan. He was a Portland cartoonist who was put in a wheelchair by a traffic accident.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
All right, that was Dermot O'Connor, the angry animator. And if you like what you heard from Dermot and you want to learn more about what he thinks and does, you can find more at his website. It is called idleworm.com, a blog made entirely by hand. So I'm looking at his most recent entry. It is labeled Occult. Strange Angels, Jack Parsons TV show. And there's an image of the Magus from the Crowley Toth tarot deck. So if that sounds like it's interesting to you, go to www.idleworm.com. That's like a worm that's not doing anything. IDLEWORM, idleworm.com. And while you're fishing around for websites, you might check out the weekly webcomic that I do. It's called Geb. That's G-E-B-B. Golf, Echo, Bravo, Bravo. That's one of the names for the Egyptian deity who is the personification of the earth. And the website is geb.io. So I.O., probably for folks living in the technological first world, means input-output, but the domain name .io is actually Indian Ocean. But the comic is geb.io. That's where you can find it. The comic, if you haven't seen it or don't know about it, is about a group of aliens who have a base underground in Antarctica, and they do what aliens do, at least according to contemporary UFO lore. They fly around in their flying saucers, and they kidnap human beings, mostly at night, snatching them out of their beds. They take them back to the underground base, where they give them an anal probe, and then they take them home again. And they smear their memories. They don't really erase their memories, but they blur them out a bit before dropping the people off. Now, this whole notion that aliens would basically kidnap people and, as Terence McKenna liked to say, provide pro bono proctology work, is absurd, right? Well, the conceit of the story is that it is absurd to the aliens actually doing the work. They don't want to do it. They don't see any point in it. They certainly don't get any satisfaction from it. But it's their job, so they do it. But then they look elsewhere for fulfillment. You know, they look to popular culture. They look to video games. They look to drugs. They look to food. They do all the same things that we do to avoid looking at our lives squarely and with clear eyes and realizing that we are oftentimes utterly squandering our time here on Earth. Our precious incarnation is being spent going to jobs that we hate, trying to win the approval of people that we don't actually like very much, and basically just going with the flow and doing what's easy and allowing ourselves to become conditioned and addicted by electronic media. We're certainly each capable of living better, more admirable lives than we do. And yet we're tired, we're scattered, and we do what's easy. So this is the episode of the podcast, surely, that will fall closest to 9/11. You know, September 11th, 2018. I don't have a whole lot to say on that topic other than in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 and in the years following, the event was used as a pretext to get us into a foreign war and also to beef up the systems of domestic surveillance and social control at home. And it was a manufactured fear of Islamic terrorists, which drove our acceptance of this enormous, obscene expenditure, which was the war, and of the enormous, obscene relinquishment of our personal liberties in the form of things like the USA Patriot Act. Well, the language and the imagery being used to get us to give up our liberties has changed. Now, instead of Islamic terrorists, we are supposed to be afraid of racists and white nationalists who are congregating in backwoods, backwater places to coordinate the Fourth Reich and their takeover of government. This is not only stupid, but it is also a very clear continuation of conspiracy theories that get propagated by the middle classes. People who are still fairly prosperous in this disintegrating economy. Actually, the economy is churning along. It's doing quite well, but one of the things that it does quite well is sequester wealth in fewer and fewer hands and leave more and more people desperate. And if you are among that class of people who is still doing pretty well, still pretty prosperous, it might be entirely rational for you to fear the lower classes. But the idea that the ideology that motivates the lowest of the losers and disposable people in our society, which is to say, you know, the sorts of people who would join white nationalist militias or the KKK, to believe that that ideology is coming from the very top of the pyramid, that the people in the halls of power are pulled by the strings of white nationalists, that is just as absurd, just as stupid as the idea that the most powerful organizations in the world move at the direction of the learned elders of Zion. Yes, the uneducated, bigoted, uncouth lower classes might well look at you with hatred, but that hatred is just as likely to stem from envy at the privileges that you enjoy as it is from anger based on skin color, sexual identity, or ethnic origin. So I think 9/11 is a good anniversary upon which to reflect on the psychological vulnerabilities that prompt us to give up our freedoms to cynical systems of control, social control, psychological control. But don't get too fixated on the specific forms, because they do change over time. The narratives to which they appeal change over time. But if you were frantically tweeting about people in power in Washington, D.C. flashing white power symbols at one another, or at us, on TV, at a Supreme Court justice nomination hearing, it's time to take a deep breath and realize that you are propagating a maladaptive meme. It's bad for you, it's bad for the society. Reel that shit in. In terms of stoking the dumpster fire, which is the social media conversation taking place in this country, posting about Xena Bash flashing a white power hand signal at the Senate confirmation hearings is no different, no better, than working yourself up into a righteous lather about sexual child slavery taking place in a Washington, D.C. pizza and ping pong establishment. All right, so 9/11, didn't mean to harangue you about it. Just practice a little mimetic hygiene, all right? Before you propagate a conspiracy theory, check in with Snopes.com. Really. All right. That is all for this episode of the CROM Podcast. Thanks for listening. And for Vault subscribers, I will talk to you again quite soon. For those of you who listen only to the free podcast, well, I will talk to you again sooner or later. And until your next hear my voice, I hope that you stay well.